You know, I had a conversation with a youngster last week, Friday. I think he is in his 30s. And he was making a point that he thought that I would perhaps have reason to support the DLP. But he's saying that his generation has no use for the DLP because of what they have seen, right? I had made the point before in articles and said that the challenge the DLP faces now is that their last good year was 1971. Right? In 1971, I was four.
Very true.
I am now 50, which means that I am in the, not in the departure lounge, but the semi-departure lounge. So the challenge is that there are not a lot of active voters who are older than me that are enough to sustain the DLP based on what is new. Now, but the point is that you're saying that this is basically the end of the road, yes, for the DLP as you know it. What I am suggesting to you, sir, is that it need not necessarily be the end because the DLP can be reborn. If you're saying that the basic thing is the vision of Arab Barrow, right? And I made the point in an article the other day that I saw the PNC struggle for years and years to redefine itself because they refused to acknowledge and apologize for the nonsense that Burnham did, right? And let's be frank. There was a lot of good in Burnham, but he did a lot of foolishness. If it is that you can apologize for that, get that out of the way. Then you can start to rebuild anew. Let us identify the salient aspects of Arab Barrow's vision. That thing that Mia did with the Barbados Labour Party's covenant, right? The covenant of hope. Yeah. The covenant was hope was essentially that, you know. Let's look back and see what are the fundamental principles. Let's apply them to currently what's going on. And let us use our time now in opposition to build that ethos. Build it around new candidates, new people that have the same vision and want to carry the party back. I honestly believe that with that, the Democratic Labour Party can come back again and bounce back and start to gain support.
I know you object to that. Let me give you a little history. And
I think you're being a bit unfair, though.
No.
And I know the Congress argument. I know the Conservative Party argument. But it's a different dynamic.
Unfair and truthful is two different things. Now, let me look at 1976. Mm-hmm. You know that between 61 and 66, up to 71, as you said, was a very good time for the Democratic Labour Party. And at that time, Crawford was in the party, that was actually a merger between the Congress and the Democratic Labour Party. But look at the leadership between 76 with a group of people that came to the fore to rescue the Barbados Labour Party. You had people like Sir Henry Ford, Bree St. John, Tom Adams, Lizzie Bowling, and a group of them that was seen in the public domain as people with leadership qualities. Even in the 70s going on, you had people in the Democratic Labour Party, like Richie Haynes, Bramford Tate, Sir Lloyd, and those type of people that were seen nationally. Tell me anybody now, within the last group or the common group, as nationalists in this country, none of them.
But sir, you don't know who come in.
Man, what come in? Well, you looking for?
Listen, I agree with you. No, not necessarily. Adam, so you don't know who come in, sir.
But
listen.
You need a
point. No, I mean, I know. I might know things that you don't know.
But you know a thing.
I know you'll be surprised.
Sir,
listen, there are people waiting in the wings of the Democratic Labour Party that have spoken to me that I believe will attract public attention.
But who tried to figure that out at them?
It might very well be.
In 1971, Richie Hill ran in his hometown, and people saw him as the heir to Arab Barrow, and he was rejected by the public.
Right.
And it's only after 1978 that he went into an urban constituency.
But sir, no one can guarantee anything.
I know, but you would like them to come back. They ain't coming back.
I am saying, in a question I would like or not like, we discussing this thing analytically. We discussing it, not that we have a vested interest.
That's what you're doing too.
Right. And I'm saying to you that I am agreeing with you that the current lot, I feel that are going to have an argument, a challenge presenting themselves to the public of Barbados. But I got people, they may very well be a Barack Obama waiting in the wings.
Wait, what? Jesus going to bring it?
But you never know.
My Democratic Labour Party is good as gone, done. D-O-N-E, done. And you, all the hope that you got, if you want to carry a poll on whether they're going to come back or not, hey, let's try to help you with that poll.
No, I think you're right, though. You're right in suggesting that I need to do some writing And exactly. I must give you this commitment, sir, that I plan over the next 5 to 10 years to spend a lot less time working on, you know, other things and a lot more time writing, as long as the finances can work itself out. Writing about this history of our development and the Democratic Labour Party's, you know, rise and fall has to be an important part of it. There has been a phenomenon that took place even before the last election, where the Barbados Labour Party has grown new support in a way that is phenomenal. And I commented about it statistically before. I'm saying that this has basically sealed the deal. And it is an interesting time for political commentators and writers to reflect on. And I'm saying to you that even though I believe that all of this is true, and I mean it is, you know, it's not necessarily the best of times, but I believe that there is a way back. In my article on Sunday, I talked about the option that the United Bermuda Party pursued, which is essentially their shut up shop, and they started a new organization with different people and some of the same people. That's a route that I don't know whether the DLP can go, right? But I do believe that there are other options. For example, you can have coalition options that the PNC did in Guyana, the PNCR, and now it has become the APNU in association with other parties. You've seen new parties like Team Unity, People's Partnership in Trinidad and Tobago. You've seen new political entities form and come to the fore. Those are options. Or alternatively, the DLP can have a new ethos where it's essentially just shed the old guard, and they look to bring forward new and exciting people. And contrary to what you believe, there are new and exciting people who have a DLP inclination that may well want to come forward. I may very well be one of them. You never know.
All right, let me finish on this.
And some might consider me new and exciting. Others may consider me old and washed up.
Please give me my last bit.
Sure, go ahead.
All right. Now, I'm going to bring an analogy to you. Now, after the death of Earl Burr, you had three prime ministers. Sir Lloyd, David Thompson, and Stuart. Now, I can deal with the term limits. You know, when you look on a clock, you have a second hand, mm-hmm. a short hand, and a long hand.
Mm-hmm.
That's three. I refer to the three prime ministers after Earl Burr as hands on the clock. Now, I can give David Thompson a second hand. He ran fast within 1 year, and he passed on 1 year. I know the second hand moved faster than the long or the short. Mm-hmm. Good? Okay, gives Sir Lloyd the second hand on the clock. His term in office, he called it short. Because, you know, he went on the 5 years after everybody died. But his first 5 years, he called it short. Because they called it in 94, but it was a Jew. That's the short hand. The long hand is short. His term, he went longer than Jew. So that's the long hand. So you had a second hand, a long hand, a short hand. And the clock face complete. And they're done. Thank you, Peter.
Sir, don't go. Somebody said to me, Mr. Stewart has already apologized, Peter, and the party has been punished by the electorate and abandoned by the people. What more could people want? The people better be minding their new ministers and leader now. If the DLP rebuilds, or how the DLP will do it, should be left to the DLP. And I just want to say to you, ma'am, and I believe that we lost you already, sir, that...
No, I'm still here.
Are you still here? Right. Well, I'll let you comment on that then. So if the DLP rebuilds, it should be left to the DLP on how to do it. What do you think?
But the DLP is people. They keep telling you that. Mm. You could got an organization, but you ain't got no people. Mm. You had the UPP, you ain't got no people. Could there, if the people in with a party, you form a party, it don't make any sense. I tell you that the DLP is doomed. Mm-hmm. They have to deal with the issues pertaining to George Street. I would like to know if it is true that they are indebted to Clico. There's a lot of things that you got to look into the Democratic Labour mm-hmm. Party running financially, furthermore than getting candidates.
Right.
Thank you, Peter.
Thanks a lot for calling, sir. Look, for my own part, the Democratic Labour Party has challenges, but the idea of saying that the DLP's business is for the DLP is foolishness. The DLP is a political party. It offers itself. If I am going to comment on the potential of an organization like the People's Partnership in Trinidad and Tobago or Team Unity in St. Lucia, in St. Kitts, why should they not be discussing the future of the Democratic Labour Party in Barbados? The DLP is a party that's offering itself to Barbadians, and a healthy DLP is in the interest of all Barbadians. I definitely think it is something we ought to discuss on this program. And if the DLP has not yet realized that their business is the people's business, then they have another thing coming. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Down to Brass Tacks. I'm just reliably informed that the CCJ has just indicated another major victory that the mandatory death penalty that Barbados adheres to is unconstitutional. So CCJ has just ruled that the mandatory death penalty for murder in Barbados is unconstitutional. So another CCJ victory, another indication that the CCJ is not as useless as some of us would want to have suggested that it is. And I certainly am happy to hear that Barbados will be continuing with the CCJ. As you know, I am not a fan of the death penalty. And to hear that at least the idea of a mandatory death penalty is no more gives me great happiness. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning.
Yes, sir.
Yes, can you hear me?
I can hear you perfectly, sir.
Yes, yes. Good morning to you. Good morning to listeners. First of all, I just want to make two quick points. But before you do that, I wonder if our Mr. Undecided is under the weather or issues overseas, because I haven't...
Phone isn't working. Her phone has not been working.
Oh,
the text part working, though, because she texting me and we chatting via text all the time, but the calling part ain't working.
Yes.
The text part working, yeah.
I was concerned about her because, you know, she didn't make a lot of vital contributions to the calling program. You know, so I was just concerned.
Stricker's 10-3, yeah, he can't hear, he neither. I don't understand what's going on.
Okay.
Phone ain't working.
Okay.
What we're going to have to do is start a special fund to buy cell phones for these people. Temporary cell phones.
Yes,
little technology fund. We give Miss Undecided one, we give Stricker's 10-3 one.
One, yes, that's right. Sir, I would just like to say for the Democratic Labour Party, as far as the Democratic Labour Party is concerned, some people may be over the moon that they lose the government. But at the same time, what people must realize that some DLP, Democratic Labour Party supporters, might have helped the BLP government to win, because some of them might have gotten frustrated and they might switch their vote to the DLP. So when you look at it, you still have to give the DLP praise, you know, because some supporters might have switched that. Yeah, that is my belief. And finally, sir, I am saddened to hear that there's another death which occurred yesterday. And what troubles me with this whole thing, with this gunplay and thing, is that if you check in, sir, you will see that it is, when you see a man on the ground dead, it is the ordinary black man killed by an ordinary black man by himself. It is never an Indian that gunned down another Indian or white man. I don't know why. And the trouble is, these people with these guns got to realize that they are putting families under a lot of stress, because sometimes that person that is killed is the only sole breadwinner in the family. And secondly, the families now very often got to struggle to get money to pay the undertaker, because when a person is killed, they have to be buried, they can't stay. So the undertakers now still have to be paid, and that is putting a lot of people under pressure, you know. So I mean, this gun thing, it is time for these senseless gunmen to sit down and study the kind of pressure and thing that they're putting people under. God didn't put us down here to destroy each other. We have to live together with each other. And when God's ready and say, well, it's time to come home. That is what life is about, sir. It is sickening. You listen to the radio from the morning. You hear the music and think you feel good. Then to hear this stupid thing over and over. Sir, I want to thank you.
All right, sir. Thank you. Thank you so much for calling. I have one here. Final nail in the coffin for the DLP is nigh at hand. They cannot reboot, reform, or re-emerge after this defeat because they do not know how to do it. They have no vision, too many things to address before they can be seen as an alternative. Their legacy is that of a party that took us back to economic slavery and disenfranchisement twice in our history. First time, voters are aware of this and have said no to them. I believe this time it will be permanent. Such a sad, strong statement. Dr. Brass Tacks, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning, ma'am. How are you doing?
I'm fine. How are you?
Good, good.
Okay. Right. What
I thought for a moment that you were the Trinidadian lady.
Oh, well, I'm not.
She's the next one that we got to get a phone for, too, because I can't hear her neither.
Well.
Sorry, dear.
I'm sure she heard you. What I'm calling about, though, is an issue that has been with us for quite a while. I'm talking about price control.
What control?
Price control. or lack thereof, to be more specific.
Repeat what you said. What control? Oh, price control. Price control, yes. Okay.
No, I'm thinking about this in relation to the amount of ministries that we have now under this new administration. And I'm saying that it's, to use Prime Minister Motley's favorite term, it's kind of passing strange that such a marquee problem for Barbados, there has been nothing specifically voiced about whether or not we're going to do anything meaningful about it. So I'm just wondering how come that is, because, you know, we have the blue economy, we have all these nice buzzwords about to make us feel that we're there or thereabouts with the movers and shakers in the world. But things that have affected Barbadians across administrations, like we've given it various names, like price gouging or maybe just the workings of the free market. How do you feel like looking at that abstraction? We know it exists, and it exists under each administration. So I'm just saying, I'm finding it really strange that there is nothing being said about anything to be done specific about it. Because, it, as I see it, it's almost as though when you go to the supermarket, the owners of the supermarkets would have gotten up one morning and just yawned and stretched and called ahead and told the guy in the stockroom to, like, shoot a few more bullets out of the pricing gun. There doesn't seem to be any, you know, form or structure guiding them, or more importantly, controlling them in terms of how they price the items and so on.
Ma'am, I think I recall hearing the Prime Minister indicate in her one of her presentations that this was something that was going to engage the attention of the administration. In terms of when the NSRL comes off, ensuring that we benefit and that there will be greater attention paid. At the same time, however, I appreciate that it's a challenging matter to deal with. I am not a person who supports price controls. I think the best price control is competition. But the idea of having an artificial price control, I am often concerned that it can very well lead to shortages. Because if you force me to set an artificial price for an item, then, I mean, my way of responding is that, well, maybe I just won't sell it. If you force me to sell it at a low price, then
well,
I would just not sell it.
I might have put it badly. I'm not speaking in terms of actual telling somebody price. I'm thinking of the structures in place to promote that the price that they actually put there is one that's fair and that it's monitored and that there is some justification for them changing it. Nothing is arbitrary. Yeah. I mean, for example, we are, I don't know how you see it, but if you look at this in the context of, like, even a vehicle, there is no one element within it, including the driver, that is out of control if it's not to end badly. So within a market structure, it seems a little ridiculous that we can have a system whereby somebody can basically just say, okay, tomorrow I want to buy some property in Florida, a holiday home, sometime share, so the price tops up in time for Christmas. That's how it has always seemed to Barbadians, and nothing seems to be changing. Yeah. As I was having a discussion with friends recently, there's some interesting phrase that Miss Molly would have thrown out about, don't worry, I got this to the public. Did she also say this to the private sector when she took off NSRL? Don't worry, guys, I got this, you know. It's going to not affect consumers, but it's also not going to affect your bottom line.
All right, ma'am. Unfortunately, I can't really interrogate this any further with you. I'd love to, if you want to stay on the line, feel free. And we can pick it up when we come back from the regional roundup. Because we have to take a break now for the regional roundup. This is a very important issue, and I hope that you can continue with me for a while. We'll be right back in about 10 minutes. Welcome back to Down to Brass Tacks. Are you there, ma'am?
Yes, I'm here. I got Dennis to call me back.
Okay, good. So, well, look, let's continue and see if we can dissect this issue. I'm with you on the need for
price structuring.
Price structuring, yeah.
Yeah.
But my questions to you are a couple of things. What would be the ideal mechanism? For you? No, two things, and then you can respond. What would be the ideal mechanism for monitoring this? And secondly, what's to stop you as a consumer from saying, "Oh, this is too expensive, I'm not interested in buying it"?
Because that's the luxury that neither you or I can always adhere to. Let's be realistic here.
But why not?
For example, if you needed to have heart surgery, will you say that's luxury that I can't afford? You can't. That would be suicidal. So let's get real here. It's always good to take these high road nonsense sometimes, but we have to be practical. In terms of, like, monitoring, I'm thinking, for example, my paper guy, a whole head of Rastalox pile upon his head. And recently, he had to be in that photo outside Taylor's Cycle Center getting one of those odd little space age helmets because there was a structure in place saying that by Monday, if you want to be on the road.
Also, there are helmets for him now?
In that cattle.
A space
age? So he has to be there. So I'm just saying that Barbados can and have, by example, manage this whole concept of recognizing a problem and putting systems in place to monitor it, to control it, and more importantly, like our building infrastructure, to maintain it. And that is the missing element that has always obtained in terms of price control. And I'm going to say this next bit because it is true. The only reason it never exists with the merchants is because a lot of the times the merchants and the politicians are usually hand in hand, and they become closer as a love entity around political season when you have to, you know, underwrite all of these meetings.
The cost of a campaign.
So come on, let's, as I say, keep the conversation real here.
But let's, no, and I'm keeping it real, you know. I was talking to Dennis off here, and I made a couple of admissions, and one of them is that I am not a terribly good shopper, right? If I go to the supermarket and I want something and I have the money, I invariably buy it. I'm not a good person in terms of checking and whatnot, but I'm just saying that I'm not the average shopper. I think that there are many shoppers who do. There's some things that I see in my favorite supermarket that, in my opinion, are too expensive and should not cost what they cost, right? I have seen instances, for example, where I have taken things to the cashier, and the cashier has herself told me, Peter, do you realize how much this thing costs?
Exactly.
And suggested to me that I may want to find another item, or alternatively be at least aware
of
what I'm doing. No, the point I'm making, ma'am, is that the fact that these things are so bought tells me something. Because if it is that you have things in a supermarket which are too expensive, and we are still buying them, either it means that everybody is careless like me, or alternatively, people see themselves as not having an option. And the fact of the matter is that you do have an option, right? You do have an option. There's nothing that you absolutely need to use that you can say is priced in that way. You talked about heart surgery. If that's the example that you're using, of course, government has an obligation to control those prices legally. Because if there's only one importer of rice, then government ought to control the price of rice. But the fact is that once you have competition, there is absolutely no reason why competition should not hold on prices.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Okay, so tell me, how do we deal with this reality?
No, I didn't want to just cut in here and be rude, but I'm just thinking, when you were asking, in terms of our alternatives, we also have an alternative to government, which is anarchy. But we choose, as a democracy, to put government in, to operate in a more ostensibly civilized manner, a sort of contract of good faith. We put you there to make the rules for us, and we take it for granted that you'll make them to our benefit. So that's what I'm saying. Of course, we know we can let those things in the supermarket rot. They would, those people that would have to call back the real estate agent in Florida and say, that house in the Gables, cancel it. It would hurt both of us. I know that. I don't need to state it. But in the interim, there's always a happy medium. That's where government, as against anarchy, and picketing outside somebody's supermarkets comes, and we are taking the high road, okay? So if we are, and especially in this administration, that has all these rarefied ministries, minister in the minister's office, ministers in the minister's back pocket. I mean, we can have a marquee ministry that deals with price structuring, importantly, regulatory monitoring, and our all-important Achilles heel, maintenance. That is always missing in any framework that we operate, and I'm saying it has never been, and it's not now an accident.
But ma'am, so, and it's part of the reason.
I am behind Ms. Motley. Don't get me wrong here. 100%.
I'm not saying that. We gone past that.
Because that's nobody's business. I could not care if she's gone in there or not, but I want her to succeed, but not to do a lousy job. You know, we don't want to be taken for a ride in a shiny new car. That's all I'm saying.
Right.
So when
okay.
she comes up with these statements, it kind of rankles when you're looking on the ground. I heard another caller on the program call a while ago saying that she's almost using the analogy of an octopus.
She's known as what?
An octopus. You have taken back the NSRL, but you have no put on either. And I smile when that guy said that because people are noticing it. You know, it's okay to come and say, I'm doing this. But at some point, the dust settles and you realize, hey, you know, this thing levels
up. Yeah,
I am exactly the same place I was before.
But this isn't a government issue that we're discussing. And let's move beyond that. What I'm trying to get from you is constructive suggestions as to how it is government can control the issue of prices. Right. I'm saying to you that my basic position is that I think that, you know, you're right that they obviously needs to be controlled. But I'm saying that the best control price control you could want is competition. And the fact is that you do have the option. And I asked you a simple question. Why do people still take up things which are overpriced? And you haven't really answered. Someone has written and they're saying, Peter, the Prime Minister did say that at the moment there's an issue where persons are increasing the prices so that when the NSRL is removed, their prices will not be affected. And what we are seeing is that businesses are not prepared to absorb the increase in utilities by offsetting them with removal of the NSRL. They prefer to maintain the same profit margin, passing these added costs on to the consumer. Now, that person is agreeing with you, basically, and saying that we're not able to have a reduction. But I'm saying we need to go beyond that, and we need to ask ourselves, why is it the entity called Julien started in the 1990s? And what essentially they started to do is to offer a better pricing structure.
Exactly.
So they bought in bulk, and they were offering better prices. And in no time at all, they had the market cornered.
And
we have an entity now,
ma'am,
we have an entity now that's doing the same thing, right?
Is that?
There's an entity, don't worry, they have two of them. There's one up in Christchurch and there's one down by me. Right.
It's interesting that you and I can recognize Julien as the entity and I'm not.
No, but Julien is closed, so I can talk about it, but I'm not advertising for anybody else.
I'm thinking, Mr. Wickham, in terms of a name whose business model everybody can see that could have operated as a profitable concern, and yet everybody would have flocked to them to realize that their prices were reasonable and not just seasonally reasonable, but consistently. That's like when you mentioned Julien.
Right, but the point, do you understand the larger point I'm making now? So I'm saying that there are entities in Barbados to offer a far more competitive price. But the industry leader in Barbados is not always competitive price wise. But I'm trying to understand from you, why do people still go and pick up things and pay for them? Ma'am?
I don't even think we're on the same page here.
We are.
No,
ma'am, because until we can understand the psychology of a shopper, we cannot implement, because it's a very difficult thing to do to implement monetary mechanism for prices, you know. It's a very, very difficult thing to do. Let's say, for example...
wait a minute. I need to get in a word here, okay? There's a conversation.
You've been getting in a lot of words, ma'am. Don't worry.
If it's very difficult to implement pricing mechanisms, why do the merchants make it seem so easy? So that is it only difficult for government then? That's my concern.
No, we're talking about a mechanism to monitor price increases and to control them. So I'm saying that's what is difficult. What did the merchants have to do with that, ma'am?
I'm thinking the way they're able to, if I go, for example, and buy a tin of box spray on, let's say, last month it's $11, this month it's $14, and that's in the real. So that's what I'm talking about here.
Right. I'm explaining to you that I'm trying to understand from you, what mechanism do you impose to monitor that price change? I'm not talking about them changing the prices. Of course, that's easy. What mechanism do you have in place that you can monitor that side of it?
Okay, if I had known, I had to give a little thesis on this, but let me just wing it here. In terms of importation, there is some sort of taxes that they have to pay
based
on what they would have purchased from overseas. And I am in the realm of guessing here, but a good brain is guessing, so I may have to fear about this. So if they are when they bring these items that they want to stick on us and they have to buy it from, say, what, Warehouse Cheapo in Brooklyn, and obviously it's coming for like $1.99, they get a percentage charge on that. By the time that same mechanism should obtain, by the time it gets to the shelf, those are the controls I get. But I think there's a kind of a black hole. As I said, I'm still guessing here, but my guesses are usually damn good. There is a kind of a black hole. It falls in between the time they get it from Warehouse Cheapo for $9.99, pay the little $3.10.
Ma'am, you need to stop a minute. Stop a minute and listen to the question that I'm asking and see if you can answer it. We have a situation where the price of BOP is $11 one week and it's $14 next week. What I'm trying to understand from you, what mechanism can government put in place to monitor increases in the price of BOP and ensure that the consumer is not being taken advantage? Back at you, ma'am. It has nothing to do with where it's sourced and all of that. Just tell me what mechanism government can put in place to control it. Back at you.
All right. At the layman's level, you have all...
At any level.
Let me take it right up from the little man in the tree. We have the people that if they can take a cell phone photograph of somebody that's just died in a motorcycle accident, they should be able to have a contact person that if, for example, they can look, most of these tickets and so on have a date on them, and they can be able to maybe take a photograph and say, okay, last month I had my bill here, it's dated, and I have an item costing XYZ, and I'm sending this to the particular entity that the government has set up for us to send these things in. And then we'll see how that works out. And I said, again, that is off the cuff. So it's not perfect. But that's just one way. I don't get the big bucks to sit down and, as a technocrat, and finagle these. That is the, that's what I'm saying. There are ways I can sit here and think of one. It's incredibly generic, but there are ways to get this done more smoothly, shall we say. But don't make it look, Mr. Vickin, as though it's impossible. I mean, I was
Ma'am, I'm not making it look like it's impossible. I'm just saying to you that this is an issue. Ma'am, hold on a second. Ma'am, I've given you opportunity to talk, but let's be fair.
Okay, sure. Go ahead.
Right? I'm saying to you, this is an issue that has come up all over the region, and invariably it's a problem. If you have a situation where there is a sole importer of a product, it is easier for government to say, you set the price and we will control the price. In a situation where you have open competition, where competing importers have the right to import from all over the place, have the right to offer competing prices, it makes it a lot more challenging. And what you're talking about, ma'am, is consumer action. We actually have a consumer association that theoretically can do that type of thing and can offer competitive pricing. We have a situation where people use Facebook to post all kind of nastiness. You can use Facebook to post prices of things which are exorbitantly priced. Some time ago, there was a name and shame campaign in relation to an entity that was operating down in St. Peter that seemed to have been overpricing, and people were using Facebook to publish the receipts to claim that that place was overpricing. Now, my point is that there's nothing to stop consumers from doing that. But you know, when it comes down to it, and someone is saying this here online, an example, ma'am, listen to me a minute, Nakadir. People control prices. An example is that broccoli was almost $20 a kilo in Canada. Mm-hmm. Broccoli rotted in the supermarket and the prices were dropped in weeks. It's the same consumers on smartphone who caused the prices to drop, and Barbadians can do the same. And my question to you, ma'am, is what is stopping Barbadians from either naming and shaming ridiculously priced items, alternatively leave them in the supermarket?
Well, we've tried it so many times before and nothing comes of it. That's what I'm saying. I just don't understand why, how come you can't see that. But no, another
but
thing.
But, ma'am, in a question of me not being able to see it, don't put it on me. You come into the program and you're saying that you have an issue that you want government to address. I'm saying to you that government has a challenge where this issue is concerned, and I'm asking you what you can suggest, and you're not coming to me with suggestions.
Well, perhaps
you are repeating the same problem over and over again and then telling me that I don't seem to be able to see the problem. I understand the problem you're having. I'm just saying, how do we address it?
No, I probably got stuck at the point, and forgive me for laughing, when you talked about the competitions, that as long as it's a monopoly, government can better control it. Because I thought instantly, and I just had to laugh a little bit there in terms of like our cell phone providers.
Ma'am, don't change the point. Don't change the point. We're talking about food. Leave out the cell phones. Let's talk about food.
Don't bring in these examples, Mr. Wickham, to bolster your point. If the shaky, I don't expect...
There's nothing shaky about it, ma'am. Listen, there have been times in the past where particular products have been controlled by government that have brought them in. Government then has a responsibility to set the price. We're not talking about phones. We're talking about food. So let's get back to the food.
I got the phone argument lost.
All right.
No, what I'm saying, Mr.
We're not going to get anywhere. I'll let you have the final word and then you can go.